Welcome to Creative Currents, a Michigan arts podcast where we discuss collaborative creativity and how the arts can spark meaningful conversations. I'm your host, Mark Clegg, and today we're joined in conversation with a filmmaker who has created a film about conversations, specifically very difficult conversations. Dr. Pratap Rugani is visiting us from the UK, where he's a professor of documentary practice at the University of the Arts London, and he has received an ARIA grant in our partnership with the Office for Vice President for Research with Professor David Chung from Stamps and Korean Studies to create a film called Impossible Conversations.
That's right.
So, Pratap, tell us about the film. What is it about?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having us here. David and I are really delighted to open the film here at the Stamps Gallery of Art. It's been a fantastic...
Is this the world premiere?
Well, yes, and quite rightly, it's rooted here because it's had huge collaborative support, not just with Professor David Chung, but also the director of the Stamps Gallery of Art, Shrimoy Mitra. We've been talking and nurturing these ideas for 3 years, and also a wonderful student and faculty collaboration. So it's a coming together of two cultures in what we are now developing, Impossible Conversations.
Well, that's fantastic because we're really trying to get that interdisciplinary arts research to happen. And so it's great to see someone putting those ideas into action. So the film is about a conversation, a seemingly impossible dialogue between two men in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in the aftermath of some pretty horrific violence. The film opens, and I got to see it this weekend. So with the voice of a man named Arno Michaelis, right?
Yes.
And who's a member of a white supremacist gang. In fact, he founded that gang. And it's a member of this gang that has killed 7 people from the Oak Creek Sikh temple, right, in Milwaukee in 2012. And among those murdered is one of the founders of the temple. And it's his son who is in this dialogue.
That's
with Arno, right? So we have these two men who've been on sort of opposite sides of this horrific event, and yet they're brought into dialogue. So how did you come to find out about this amazing connection between these two men, and what are you hoping this film sort of achieves?
Yes. Sadly, there are far, far too many of these horrific events in our schools, in our places of worship and elsewhere. And what interests me is something that emerged, probably seeds of this, through my work with the great Desmond Tutu and the Truth and Reconciliation.
You've been doing this work for a long time.
I have. I guess this theme has been with me for 25 to 30 years. I wouldn't kind of have... It's only looking back that I can see the things that really move me intellectually, emotionally, and with my body and spirit, as it were, often surface in how people of radically different experiences can come to make sense of each other. Sometimes the fractures are across class, race, gender, sexuality, many of the myriad ways in which people sadly can reach towards polarization, sometimes toxic polarization and into violence, rather than what this film flowers with, which is focusing on a path through the depths of those sorts of hatreds to find something even deeper, which is what connects us, binds us, and what's the promise of creating culture where we can dare to be human across all of these differences. And this explores that vulnerability and, to my mind, the great beauty of that journey.
For me, it was incredibly powerful to see the film, in part because, I mean, I've heard about white supremacy, but this is not part of my day-to-day experience. You know, a lot of times, you know, these sort of hate groups and you know, they're hidden away, right? They're part of, maybe there's a community on social media is bringing them to the fore, but you don't see an extended conversation with the man who says, I was part of a white supremacist group and, you know, I walk the streets of Milwaukee looking for people of color to injure. I mean, it was very powerful just to see that. And what was your thinking of having the film open in that way?
So the film opens with Arno Michaelis, who is a former white supremacist. Mm-hmm. He renounced that and went public with that shortly before, a year or two before the Oak Creek massacre. What was my thinking in opening with Arno? Well, I think in order to work with difficulty, we need to have an honest conversation about where we each other are. And very important to me, almost a principle in documentary practice, is not going to experts to speak on behalf of other people, but to work with individual lived experience out of which a more collective response and policy, those approaches can develop. But through creative art practice speak to the whole person. So audiences coming to see this don't necessarily need to know or care about hatred, race hatred, gun violence, any of these themes. What they will meet is a significant conversation, a dialogue where two people from seemingly irreconcilable positions choose to encounter each other, dare to listen to each other. And the genius, as it were, of Pardeep Kaleka, the son of the murdered temple president, Satwant Singh Kaleka, his genius, as it were, and it's good to think about this, and we've just had MLK Day a couple of days ago, is that his future, my future, our future is a collective future. And therefore, we need to hear and understand what it is that leads, in this case, often young white men to a place of toxic polarization, alienation. It's easier to blame the other, whatever form that takes. Now, that then leaves me, filmmaking, with a huge dilemma, because much of my professional work at the BBC and elsewhere, I would not seek out expressions of this kind of hatred. That would, we have a different legislative framework in the UK to the US, and we have strong guardrails on hate speech and the nature of hate speech. So if one wants to enter that territory, and I think a meaningful conversation really means listening closely and attending to the other, however uncomfortable that is, but that has to be convened, curated, to create the conditions for a dialogue which is going to go somewhere. And by that, I mean not just risk re-traumatizing victims and people who have suffered, you know, horrific violence. And that needs, you know, time, relationship. Often this has been nurtured through several years, and in my own case, training in restorative justice, restorative practices for some considerable period before then, to dare to move close to a space where a film can give deep attention to enable an audience to understand, yes, it is possible that I can dare to imagine what it's like for you, and together form that collective path forward through the darkness to something better.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the courage of the son of Pardeep Kaleka and sort of his willingness to enter into a dialogue, you know, having had his own father, you know, killed and his community sort of traumatized. His children were at the temple when it was attacked, you know, the story he tells. And yet he seems to have translated his personal grief and his personal suffering into, you know, a kind of calling to the community to heal.
Yes.
And this kind of restorative justice process you've invoked. But it just seemed like his response was really extraordinary and quite special.
Yeah, that's beautifully observed, Mark. I mean, just a factual point. His children, actually, his daughter had left some homework. They were going for, as it were, Sunday school at the Sikh temple. She had left the notebook at home. He drove back to get it. And
okay.
That meant that actually his children were not inside the Gurudwara when the shooter went in. So his parents were. And tragically, he's lost his father. His mother managed to hide in a kitchen pantry. But then, but I won't go too much detail into his story, but I think what he understood was that he was being strong for others, but inside, after a certain period, he was collapsing, and he was living out a desire to follow the teachings of, you know, relentless optimism, as it's called, Chardikala, in the Sikh tradition. But it's very easy to give a teaching. In many traditions, people will come across this idea. MLK used to talk about redemptive suffering. But the point is, and I think what film can do, is to explore what does that mean? What on earth does that mean in my life to reach towards a higher teaching? But what's the lived experience? How do I go about that in relationship to another? How do I travel this treacherous journey without the pitfalls or managing to get out of the pitfalls of despair and other things, in order to traverse the darkness and the shadows? And that's essential. I mean, Jung talks about that. Jung talks about, to use the gendered language, to use the quote, he talks about some men grow more through the darkness than the light. like some plants. And I think as a culture in the West, to speak very, this will be wrong in certain instances, but broadly speaking, as a culture, we're not very good at walking through an absence of light and knowing how to be there. These two fine men do is to show how one can attend to some of the worst losses imaginable in a human life. You know, the violent murder of a close, of a loved one, a parent, a child. How does one come back from that? How does one integrate that and move forwards? And I've been helped in this by the work of Marina Cantacuzino, founder of the Forgiveness Project, and researched many examples of restorative justice. And that, to me, those are the stories that should be sort of headlines in our news. But we, unfortunately, have yet to invent a better way of storytelling where we're not left with these very polarized binary oppositions where audiences are asked to choose between right and wrong. There is a right and wrong, of course, with violence. But the deeper human journey is how do we attend to each other's struggles with our common purpose?
Right, and seeing it as maybe indicative of the system rather than the individuals, or at least there being a shared responsibility.
That's right, and the water we swim in is changing in storytelling. So just last week, the new inverted commas guidelines on hate speech from Meta, which of course control Facebook and Instagram, the way our journalistic values are under pressure, the distortion of storytelling, the notion of so-called alternative facts. This is making the water we swim in much muddier with intentional misinformation and disinformation. And at this perilous time, I think the arts can contribute by insisting on deeper truths and more creative ways of connecting with each other. So I think we have a huge and beautiful opportunity to rethink storytelling.
No, that was so powerful, powerfully said, and I think it is so pertinent to our times. But one of the things in my experience of the film is it's a relatively short film.
That's right, like 29 minutes, 45.
Yeah. And so, you know, you get introduced to this amazing story. You meet Arno, you meet Pardeep, you see them speaking to one another and actually holding hands at that moment. And it's so powerful. And yet, then the film sort of ends, you know, in a way. You know, and so this sense of hope and possibility that you see this relentless optimism in action, but it's clear that the film is a beginning of something.
Yeah.
It's not the complete story. And so I think that was one of the really interesting artistic choices you've made by sort of not giving the conclusion. I got the message as a viewer that I was supposed to enter the story, that I was supposed to
exactly
have this optimism and to have the courage to enter into some of these conversations.
Yeah, and I think all of the team, David, Shimoy, myself, everybody who's helped with it, we kind of end the film with a sort of dot, 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 if it was a sentence. And we come out of that space, which is an immersive, I mean, quite, we can talk about the aesthetic, it's quite an unusual framing and ratio we've used. We come out of that space into a research space where there's a lot of materials, there are a lot of contacts for example, parents who have a child who's becoming radicalized, and Arno works with groups that respond to that. And then we have a dialogue space, and there's a lot of materials there that give further reading and ways to explore it. So yes, absolutely, Mark. The point is that it's my job now, if as an audience person, to think about, well, what are the polarizations that disfigure my life? How do I dare to attend to those people? And this is not a naive attention, where I'm not expecting to agree with everybody. I'm not expecting to persuade anyone, but I'm looking for something much deeper than whether we agree or disagree with each other. And what is that faculty in a culture where the connective tissue of what makes us a people, where that is newly under strain? How do we reform that? And that's what we're reaching for. And that puts the responsibility right back with you and me.
Yeah, no, that was really clear and visceral for me in experiencing the film. The film is really fabulous from an artistic standpoint. I mean, so you mentioned the format. So it's, you know, you'd have to give me the dimensions, but it's not meant for a traditional movie theater, right?
It's a long letterbox. It's immersive. It's like 50-something foot by about 8 foot, the way it's projected.
Yeah, so it's super wide.
It's super wide.
It's a giant
immersive
rectangle.
Yeah.
And yeah, it fills up. You can barely even see the whole thing at once. I was sitting in like the second row. But one of the interesting things you do with that is, for example, during the dialogue where the two men are talking to each other, you see two views of them simultaneously.
Yes.
The one of the sort of a medium shot of the two of them seated, and then one a close-up of the speaker.
That's
and
it.
So what was interesting to me about that as a viewer was the sort of the way it sort of visualize different perspectives simultaneously to having to look at things from different angles and at the same time.
And
understand it from both the speaker's perspective and the listener's perspective or the you know, the person in dialogue. So was that intentional?
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I'm so grateful that you've picked up on that. So in a lot of, I've made 35 films, a lot of them for BBC TV, Channel 4, WGBH, some of those sort of public service kind of contexts. And typically what I've done, and I've worked in Rwanda, South Africa, Aboriginal Australia, many places where peoples are having to reconnect in following the aftermath of extreme difficulty or atrocity, is that you'll interview one side and then you interview the other side of the argument or the situation, and then you'll intercut those. And I think the unique thing, maybe the gift even of this finding our way to this way of working, is that we've got each side present to the other, talking with the other, explaining what it was like with those, you know, radically different perspectives, even violent behavior, and they're having to explain that to the other person, not to a journalist or a filmmaker or an artist, someone from coming from the outside. Yes, we're there to witness, but I saw my role, and this required a lot of reconfiguration for me, was to sort of step back from being the person asking the questions and talking to me, and more sort of convening a creative space where an encounter might happen. And there's a profound responsibility in doing that, that one isn't manipulative in the pejorative sense in doing that, because there's a certain power in convening a space, and that has to be done with a deep sensitivity to how the good, as it were, can flower in that space, not simply trying to find a sink bite where someone's very distressed and you get something cinematic. That's not the point. That's kind of easy to do. Unfortunately, there's a lot of that, but that doesn't leave the participants in the situation any better off necessarily. It just leaves them being able to state quite a strong position. So when we come to the filmic choices, it was really important to me to have a wide two-shot of these two men in dialogue. And I think that's where the body language, their ability, is two middle-aged straight men to hold each other, to dare to touch. They remain holding each other's hands through, you know, some very deep and visceral sharing of what their journeys have been. And there's a, I know you won't misunderstand me, the nature of love in friendship is present there. How much more powerful that is because it's a former white supremacist. He's done some truly dreadful things, and the son of someone who was murdered by the group founded by the former supremacist. So when we're at that level of human communication, you don't have to do stuff to heighten the drama, as it were. The job much more is to witness and gently observe in a way that can meet the power of that human communication. So that left us with, you know, two shots insisting on seeing the men together whilst also running the big close-ups of them speaking. So hopefully that created a more, a broader environment that was more immersive. So you feel I've had, you know, that's 29 minutes of my life that's been well spent, and maybe plant a seed for me to think about where that leaves me in relation to in my context.
No, that was very powerful for me. How does sound and sort of the sound design fit into that? I mean, there's music in there, but it's also a very clean, open, there are periods of, you know, silence of without music, obviously, that sort of seem to create that openness that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is, I think I work very closely with David Chung, who looked after a lot of the editing choices as well. And we were very spare in our use of music. I mean, music and the sound world is extremely powerful. And in the empire of the senses, the vision often dominates. And there are moments where I think if you do it right, film can allow sound music to lead us, but lead us in a way that's integral to the story, not just sort of putting some, you know, effect music on something. But the music emerges in relation to and is stimulated by the ideas of the film and then leads the film. So I'll give you one example, the Growal twins, they sing some Sufi music, very unusual for women to sing Sufi music. I felt it was super important to have that. And the words that they sing are about, it's in the context, in an Indian context, and they sing about how Hinduism, Sikhism, Islam are no different. And in the Sufi tradition, there's a search for what is true to us, whatever our faith background. I mean, you see it in America, really. If you look at the most popular poets in American literature, Rumi is typically up there as one of the main best-selling poets. And a lot of those people are from other faith traditions or none. Right. And the Sufi promise...
I have Rumi poetry at home.
There we go. And so the music was drawing out those principles. And also we have the great Brian Eno there. And also my... I really admire Hari Prasad Chaurasia, the flautist. And we picked a refrain where that goes across the memorial shot of the seven people who tragically lost at that temple shooting.
So the film is called Impossible Conversations, and of course it features an actual conversation that's happening, but you're trying to inspire a sort of a domino effect of these, you know, these difficult conversations. And so can you talk a little bit about where this film will go? I mean, I know we're seeing this as part of a larger educational project, right? To bring students to show this film and bring it into galleries really worldwide at your university, obviously at the University of Michigan as well.
Yes, it's been fantastic interest and response to the film. I'm very grateful to the gallery for putting together a big advisory board, including a number of scholars, including a number of significant Sikh scholars. And among them, and through that, we decided to show a rough cut of the film to some of your UMich students. And they've written all sorts of responses to this film. And we've had a Q&A, and that group of fantastic students, as well as some faculty and others, have been really important in the feedback in helping us make some changes between the rough cut and the film that's now there. So seeing how this work lands with a different generation, that's very important. And to answer your question, the film, there are people, including myself, working on the pedagogy of this. So having seen this film, how can I use this in teaching, in learning? How would I frame it? What kind of questions? What will enable dialogue and debate? And young people are crying out for this in a very polarized time to see, well, how can we be in the same space with each other? How can the model of these two men, Pardeep and Arnaud, if they can do it in relation to the most horrendous suffering and violence, how can we do it as students and faculty where we might have different views about some really defining questions for us, not just at home, but in the Middle East and elsewhere? And I'm less interested in the particular positions people take about that. I'm much more interested in what an educational culture can model so that we continue to deepen what it is to be a collective culture where our differences are held in that broader frame. So a very important guiding image for me in how to direct this work is an image that comes straight from the Sikh tradition, and that's the image of the lotus. And that image is a kind of teaching. So the lotus grows from the mud and in the darkness at the bottom of the water. And then gradually over time, it sprouts and the stem starts to grow and the flower emerges at the surface of the water. But the image for me, and this is particularly important working with people who have lived out extreme suffering, is that the flower doesn't come out of nowhere. The flower comes by drawing on the nutrients in the lake, in the mud, in the darkness, and dares to push through to what a transformation of those things might be. So in its own way, the journeys of both Arnaud and Pardeep are the flowering of a kind of lotus.
That's beautiful. And the way the petals sort of reaching up to the light almost sort of creates an image of that relentless optimism.
Yes, and that's what, I mean, I was very drawn to this phrase, relentless optimism, Charity Colour, or in whatever faith tradition or nun listeners might have, whatever version you have of that. Often I think it's really easy to hear that phrase and great to hear that phrase, but the real work of growth, of being a person in relation to another person, is to understand what does that mean for me in my choices, in my ordinary choices in life. So, and that means attending to darkness as much as light.
No, it's fantastic. And, it's, you know, I can just feel in the world around us right now, people pulling away from conversation, right? That the public sphere has become so sort of dangerous or, you know, frightening.
Yes.
That people are not speaking and afraid to speak, afraid to be seen. And that just really makes me fearful for the future in certain ways.
So me too. And I feel the responsibility of that as someone who's been lucky to have a good education and in a situation where I can help by making things and teaching. I need to dig deeper and ask myself, how can I do this better at a time when we are being pushed into corners of the room, when the most interesting place is to be in dialogue with each other. And that's, it's easy to say those things, it's really hard to live it out. So I have to go to people who model that in significant ways, and then the film will move on. It's a big investment from the University of the Arts London and the some of our research centres there, and so we'll be having events and screenings there. And this is for me an early phase of a 3 to 5 year project where we'll be exploring parallel conversations in different cultures in the UK. I'm also working on one in Palestine and Israel.
Well, thank you. And thanks to David for this work. And, you know, just it's really exciting to see it move forward. And the arts being a place where we can acknowledge and affirm one another's humanity and where sort of aesthetics can open up a space of possibility, you know, for these difficult conversations. So if someone listening to the podcast wants to catch it in Ann Arbor, where can they go?
The Stamps Gallery of Art on
Division Street. Yep. So it's,
there we go.
It's
so
just off
division.
Campus. It's very easy walking distance to Central Campus, but just out off of campus. Yeah. And it's open 9 to 5 weekends. And is the film sort of running continuously? Or
it is. I mean, unusually for a gallery film, I mean, it's on all the time, but we encourage people to come for the start and leave at the finish. And it's on at 15:15 the hour every hour. But that gives people time to look at the exhibition space before and after. So I'd say to any student who gets a chance to go, please go, see if it challenges you, be in touch with us, give us your responses, tell us how we can do this better.
And I think it's there until February 8th.
That's it.
2025. So head over there right now. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.
Creative Currents is a project of the University of Michigan Arts Initiative. Please subscribe to hear more great conversations with artists, scholars, and arts leaders from across the campus and across the globe. Send your comments and suggestions via email to creativecurrents@umich.edu. This episode of Creative Currents was produced by Mark Clegg and Jessica Jenks, and our audio engineer is Audrey Banks. Our original theme music is composed and performed by Ansel Neely, a student at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance. To learn more about the University of Michigan's Arts Initiative, please visit our website at arts.umich.edu. Thanks for listening.